Okay. I almost didn't hit record. Fortunately, I have it there, and I have it there. So I'm pretty sure I remember with your help, but not on myself. Okay, we're lecture four, maybe the first one being recorded for the web-based students. Thank you. January 27th, lecture notes, pages 38. I did remember hit the record, duh. Current enrollment, 617 students. Face coverings are required. Look, it's not my rule, it's their rule. So if you don't want to wear face coverings, don't be here. Go be somewhere else. I can't help you, right? So wear face coverings. That's right. Mini test two is going to open tomorrow at 8 a.m. This is going to have a little bit of a change. So mini test one, I did not lock down the browser. You were able to. You shouldn't be going off and copying stuff and putting it on the web and looking it up, but you could. We're not going to do that after now, because you now hypothetically can get a physical copy of the book. Anybody buy the physical copy of the book? It's there. It's available. It's a thing. So now you're supposed to be using the book, studying the book, putting notes on the book, highlighting the book, and using the book that way. For these tests, I can't stop you from doing the internet, or choosing not to. But for the midterms and the finals, I'm going to record you to make sure you aren't doing that. So this is the first step towards that. Browsers will be locked down. It's different than mini test one. Just so you know, heads up, that's what's going on. Trying to work towards some academic integrity. 97% of the students did take mini test one. That means 3% chose not to. The average score is 92%, which makes sense. Five attempts, keep your top score. You'd hope you got something like a 92, right? So good job, off to a good start. Mini test two, which will open Friday, will close next Tuesday. That's the pretty much regular schedule. We know about the missing. You've seen that in your grade book now. The one you weren't supposed to take shows up as missing. All right, so this was sort of an interesting partnership, I thought, between a well-known sort of lifestyle news show, the Today Show, and Walmart, which is another pretty good retailer that we know about. So NBC's Today Show and retail giant Walmart have teamed up to create a shoppable recipe and commerce destination called Today Table. So we're seeing a bit about corporate partnerships, obviously a high-level strategic decision, and the offering of a new service, Corporate Table, online. In addition to expertise from Today and omnichannel shopping, that phrase omnichannel shopping, we have a whole chapter on that later in the course. It's not just one channel of distribution. It's not even dual channel distributions. It's distributing your product through as many channels as you can, not just direct to the consumer, not just through the retail store at a sale. It's also through having order online and pick up in store, order online, curbside. This is the whole thing now, omnichannel marketing, obviously bricks and mortar and on the web. So this is a phrase we're going to see in our upcoming chapter. So omnichannel shopping from Walmart. Today Table will feature a custom series of videos and recipe content targeted towards busy families with the goal of helping them to plan and prepare meals faster and easier. So omnichannel marketing, their target audience for this new service, and providing value to the consumer, that busy consumer who would like a way to get their meals done. Weekly recipes will tap into seasonal trends and lifestyle moments, including healthy spins on takeout dishes, as well as low-carb, low-calorie, one-pot meals and viral recipes. Making our recipes shoppable is the next natural step in our efforts to add additional layers of utility. That word we used in class, which you use in micro, is used by the people doing the trade writing to talk about this. Utility and service for our Today audience through commerce programming within a lifestyle pillar that Today's show is known to be a leader in, says this person. So we're adding value to the consumer through a new service. Let me mute my phone a little bit. Bud Light, they manufacture a product that some adults like called beer. This is picking up on an interesting trend in beer. Zero carb beer. So Super Bowl Light, Bud Light drops thousands of NFTs. When I say NFT, how many people know exactly what I'm talking about? NFT, how many people sort of maybe know what I'm talking about, but not sure? How many people do not know what I'm talking about when I talk about NFTs? Okay, this is a bizarre, I need to do a research study or have somebody do a research study on what I'm about to describe, these NFTs, which I'm going to describe in a minute. Anheuser-Busch is released, is releasing a new zero-carb beer and dropping thousands of NFTs to celebrate this new release. So we're seeing a new product introduction. We're getting consumers' attention with NFTs. I'll explain in a minute. And this is a form of something we'll talk about later on called a sales promotion to get people involved in the product. So NFTs are technically known as non-fungible tokens. That's what an NFT is. These are digital assets that are created using something called blockchain technology. And they're mostly traded using cryptocurrencies. All that sentence is pretty well packed with meaning, but let me move on to what the NFT is. The NFT is a virtual good, a digital good, an asset online. It's considered a form of digital ownership that could be applied to metaverses, gaming worlds, and Web 3.0 social platforms. But recent Forrester data, research data, shows that nearly half of U.S. adults have no idea what an NFT is. Could you go online and find a picture of the Mona Lisa? Could you do that? Yeah. Could you print it? Yeah. Could you frame the print? Awesome. You now have a framed picture of the Mona Lisa, yes? Would you say you own the Mona Lisa? No. Who owns the Mona Lisa? The Louvre. The Louvre Museum in Paris. Oh, it's lovely. Well, it's very small. So that is the idea of ownership versus what you can have access to. NFTs are available on the web, but only one person owns them. Even though you could go there, take a picture of it, copy it, and print it, you wouldn't have ownership. You would think this is cray-cray. Who in the world is going to pay for a digital asset on the web? Banksy sold an image on the web. I don't have it off the top of my mind. We talked about it a year or so ago, but for millions of dollars. Someone paid millions of dollars for an NFT, which has no physical form. It's on the web. You could take a picture of it and have it yourself, but you wouldn't own it. It's now become part of mainstream marketing, even though a third of us don't know what it is. It's a thing. So where are we going with this? The next Bud Light Next collection, that NFT project, will tie in with the release of the new Bud Light Next product, a zero-carb beer that will get a Super Bowl ad along with it. The collection will feature 12,722 NFTs, a nod to the drop date of today, January 1, 2022. So they're dropping 12,722 NFTs. Each NFT will be designed with color cues from the new Next beer packaging, and people are going to go out and buy these. How do I know that? Because in November, Budweiser released 1,936 Budweiser-themed NFTs, the Heritage Collection. Those are images up there in the upper left of what you could have bought. They sold out in less than an hour. They netted the brand $984,000. There were 1,900 core heritage cans priced at $499 a piece. How many of you guys are struggling to find $30 to buy the lecture notes? Who has $499 to buy an NFT? A bunch of people, but even better, much more limited run of 36 gold heritage cans on top sold for $999 a piece, sold out in an hour. It's an interesting world we live in. So this ties into all of that, and it will work for them. What's more, NFT holders will get to vote on Bud Light Next merchandise coming up, access to events, special privileges, and, quote, other surprises. The tokens themselves will go on sale starting February 6th for $3.99 each, so save up those quarters on the Bud Light website. Revenue from the NFT sales will be reinvested in the Anheuser-Busch InBev NFT community. Customers have to be over 21 years old to purchase. So here's the idea of price in the marketing mix. What? And understanding what some consumers value. And, of course, building a brand community. If you're that excited to spend that kind of money, you're going to be part of that community. You're going to be connected to the brand, yeah? And have special privileges. As we rush into a new era of beer with the launch of Bud Light Next, we're simultaneously seeing a revolutionary shift in the way brands engage with people on the internet. Our NFT project celebrates this new era and those who are similarly breaking barriers in technology and creativity. So here's an interesting influence of the external world technology on business, on our consumers, on marketing, and changes in consumers' tastes. They're buying digital virtual stuff at pretty high prices. Who knows, Idris Elba. My wife got all excited when she heard I was doing him. She likes him a lot. So Idris Elba gets advice from famous ad faces in Booking.com, Super Bowl preview, the travel industry. Anybody here with tourism? Tourism and hospitality? One person? The travel industry strained to reassure customers throughout the pandemic that their Dash flight and hotel plans were merely delayed. So the impact of the pandemic on marketing and business and consumers. Even Idris Elba needs a pep talk to help Booking.com sell the stand that stands to Super Bowl viewers coming up. So we're seeing the use of celebrity spokesperson, Super Bowl advertising, humor in advertising. In the Dutch online travel agency's first ever Super Bowl ad, scheduled air during the first commercial break in the fourth quarter, the actor, Idris, and an international superstar seek some advice through video conferencing from a couple of other well-known Super Bowl pitchmen. Where'd I put my clicker? Did I leave it in the other room? So what we're going to see is what gets consumers' attention in the pre-Super Bowl days. These are teaser ads. Here he is asking for some advice. Which way do I want to do this? Maybe I'll show who he's asking it from first. So this is Isaiah Mustafa. He does the Old Spice ads, which actually I like so much I use later in the course.
Hello, ladies. How are you?
You know this
fantastic
ad?
Does your man look like me? No. Can he smell like me? Yes. Should he use Old Spice body wash? I don't know. Do you like the smell of adventure? Do you want a man who smells like he can bake you a gourmet cake in the dream kitchen he built for you with his own hands? Of course you do. Swan dive!
Okay, so that goes on, and that's him. They then, by the way, this is just an aside, parodied him in a Super Bowl ad, which is pretty funny.
In the hype.
So this is
hello again, ladies.
A parody.
Is your man the kind of man who would climb the height? I'm in a tight head.
Nice pants.
Get off my horse.
So again, that's one of the people that are about to be in this teaser ad that Idris is talking to. The other guy is Jonathan Goldsmith. He was the most interesting man in the world in the Dos Equis commercials. They've been dropped a while ago, but maybe you remember seeing them.
He wouldn't be afraid to show his feminine side, if he had one. His mother has a tattoo that reads, Son. At museums, he's allowed to touch the art. He is the most interesting man in the world.
I don't always drink beer, but when I do, I prefer those Zackies.
Okay, so that's him. So now they're going to parody and play on that in this teaser ad with Idris asking for their opinion and help.
Gentlemen, hey man, thanks for taking the time to speak to me. You guys good?
Meritorious.
I'm good. How are you?
I've got a commercial. I'm going to be a spokesman for Booking.com. I really just wanted to reach out to two icons of the advertising world.
Are you going
to
be wearing a shirt?
A shirt?
Are there going to be any singing animals? Maybe fire explosions, maybe like cars driving in with people jumping out, paragliding.
I'm definitely going to be wearing a shirt.
Ooh, I got it. You reverse skydive. Have you ever done that? No. You're going to be the first.
Booking.com. Booking. Yeah.
So that's their little, booking. Yeah is one of their little taglines. Here's the final one in this series.
Booking. Yeah.
7. But great effort.
7?
6.
How about this? Booking. Yeah.
Stop. You're giving me tingles.
I got a little tingle.
Ooh. Booking.com. Booking. Yeah.
So they're generating interest with this and obviously playing off on other things as well and getting interest. People talk about this stuff. Booking.com didn't spend more than $6 million to give those other brands screen time. But Elba's confidants, Isaiah Mustafa and Jonathan Goldsmith, will be familiar to anyone who's ever used a manly body wash or put a lime in an amber beer. So we're getting consumers' interest. We're using humor. We take our business very seriously, but not ourselves. And that's also something you'll see in the campaign, says Arjun Dikluk at Booking.com's Senior Vice President and Chief Marketing Officer. The surge of U.S. travelers before the current Omicron wave was reflected in the company's most recent stats. In the third quarter, Booking.com logged 183 million room nights, 13 million car rental days, and 4 million airline tickets. Overall, it's $23.7 billion in total bookings, that's gross travel bookings, in quarter three of last year. Exceeded any quarter it's had since 2019. So here's the impact of changes in the pandemic on consumers' behavior and on businesses. Holy mackerel. All right? Marketing is everywhere. Why are you back? So we're going to pick up with lecture notes, page 38. We're going to go to the middle of page 32 in the textbook, continuing with understanding chapter 2, developing successful organizational and marketing strategies. So last time we ended up very rushed because I was at the end of the time talking, hearing from Valerie talking about mission. My point about that was once your company decides its mission, what should it do? Stick to it. Don't allow yourself, your salespeople, and your clients to drag you off mission into territories where you don't have competencies, you don't have expertise, you don't have the ability to serve. And I said, I guarantee you sometime you're going to find yourself in a company doing that. Sure, we can do that. How are we going to do that? I don't know how we're going to do that. That's not going to guarantee customer satisfaction. Your mission has to be the first intent of people doing strategic planning and has to be also driven by people on the ground. And they have to make use of that as well. So that's where we left off last time. And so today we pick up with the concept that you've probably heard of in other places, that your goals or objectives have to be SMART. Have you heard this in the context of management before? Yeah, a couple of us have. So first of all, they need to be specific. If your goals and objectives aren't specific, how do you know if you're achieving them? How do you know if you're getting to them? They have to be measurable. Same idea. If they're vague, how do you know if you're doing it? We're going to grow next year. So you grew 0.5%. Is that what you meant? You grew? What's the growth rate? Has to be attainable. Has anybody ever worked for an organization where they set out your goals for the quarter, for the month, whatever, and they're ridiculous? You know you can't make them? Have you had that happen? Yeah. Does that motivate you when they're ridiculous? No, it's the opposite. Don't do that. I can't possibly bring in another $1 million. I did $1 million last month. I can't do it again. I'm not motivated. They have to be reasonable and attainable. They have to be relevant to your particular market, consumer, the crest factors, competition, etc. And time-based. When are you planning to get this thing done? So this is the concept of what are called SMART goals in planning. It's a management tool, but we're talking also about marketing management. Yeah? So for example, as we'll see in a second, Time Warner Business Services goal is to, quote, keep our business growing 25% per year in our region. That's pretty smart, specific, measurable, presumably attainable, relevant, I presume, and time-based. Let's hear him talk about it for a second. Let's see if it works. Nope, we're going to come back to that. So we're down, driven by the company mission and objectives. We're skipping over some stuff to get to marketing objectives that are smart, drives our strategy, and drives what our people.
We have approximately 20-some thousand customers on the business side. And I believe the addressable market here is about 150,000 businesses or so in our footprint. We actually go up through Erie, PA too. So we have a little bit of that. So what we look at when we determine growth rates and things like that, okay, how many businesses are out there? Market penetration, where are we built out, passings of some sort, and what can we do to keep growing that business 25% or more per year?
And so you can hear that he's talking about those things that, in essence, make up SMART goals, right? Now, that's fine to have this as a goal, to have it as part of your plan. What does that translate into on the ground as you try to make this happen? Let's see an ad that's sort of on target with this, driving the actual business consumer to use the product.
Cooking for a crowd has never fazed us. It's what we'd love to do. That's why we started our catering business. But finding the right internet and phone provider, we just wanted services we could count on that didn't break the bank. Then we heard about Spectrum Business. Best services, best price, and no contracts. We called them and we were up and running in no time. It was so easy.
Make the right choice for your business. Get reliable internet and voice for less and no contracts from Spectrum Business.
That seems like a reasonable ad to draw consumers' attention, business consumers' attention, to help us grow over time. No contracts, low price, reliable service, up fast. Yeah? That's the thing at the very grassroots level that's driven by our strategy. So what types of goals might we have, might we set? Well, again, it depends. Everything depends in marketing. It depends. But you might set goals based on your needed or expected profit. You might set goals based on sales targets, certain amount of dollar sales, or if you like, a certain amount of unit sales, if appropriate for your situation. You might go for market share. You want to be number one or number two in baked goods in your region, for example. You might set your goals based on some level of quality. It could be high quality, Saks Fifth Avenue. It could be acceptable quality, Kohl's, Walmart. Customer satisfaction, companies that improve customer satisfaction grow faster than those that don't. Efficiency, employee welfare, social responsibility. Or obviously you could have a couple, three, four of these goals wrapped into what you're trying to attempt. But these are some types of goals you might think of. When I first put this example together, I thought this was Portage County, Ohio. It's Portage County like Washington State. But the point is, here is an example, when I put it together, of their goals for a not-for-profit organization. By next year, 90% of pregnant women will receive prenatal care in the first trimester. Seems like it's presumably, I don't know, realistic, specific, measurable, relevant. By next year, the percentage of teen pregnancies will decrease to 7% or less of all pregnancies. By next year, low birth weight babies will constitute no more than 5% of all live births. So whether you're a for-profit organization or a not-for-profit organization, you need to have goals, objectives that are driven by your mission, driven by your strategy, to help your consumers or your clients. Yeah? So as we think now about setting our strategic direction, which way are we going to go? Remember the Cheshire Cat saying, if you don't know where you're going, you can go anywhere at all. As you think about setting your strategic direction, we have what I'm being a little cute when I call the 3.5 C's of where we are now. In order to set your strategic direction, first of all, what are your competencies? If, like Valerie's group, you don't have any expertise in IT, then don't get involved in IT solutions. Maybe find a partner, some companies. But what are your competencies? What makes you good? So this is the half C. What makes your competitive advantage? What is your unique selling proposition based on? That thing which consumers come to you for over the competition. You ought to know what that is. And you ought to use it in your planning. Your customers, who are they, what do they want, what are their needs, wants, and desires, and how are they changing over time, how satisfied are they? Should help drive your planning. And, of course, your competitors. Who they be, what are they planning, what are they doing, how satisfied are their customers? So these are sort of the background issues you've got to understand as you start thinking about what strategic direction you're going to take. Are you going to grow? Where? How? With whom? Are you going to divest? Are you going to reduce yourself in size? In crisis situations, such as we have had during the COVID pandemic, which are subject to rapid change, we already talked about your future life and business in the whitewater rapids of environmental change, marketers need a proactive plan to adjust and adapt how they speak to their customers and manage their brands and their teams. They need to engage in scenario planning. What happens if what happens when a new variant comes out? What's that going to mean for us? What happens when this variant dies down? What will that mean for us? What if they come up with that vaccine that's going to cover everybody? Do our consumers use vaccines? Don't they use vaccines? What's going to happen? Scenario planning. Listen for changes in consumer sentiment and behavior because they can occur very rapidly, very quickly, especially in a crisis situation like this where everybody's, how many of you guys feel a little on edge? One person. You know what I mean? That you're sort of on edge. Anything can make you go one way or another way. Anticipate the operational impacts of these changes. Of course, that's hard to do. And then adapt your marketing plan as necessary, given these changes that are occurring, right? So, where do we want to go? Do we want to grow? Yes, well, that's great. How, with whom, in what way, what regions, how fast? Do you want to sustain? Man, you would just like to hang in there until this crisis. How many folks work for a restaurant, work for a bar, whatever? And are they doing great or are they trying to sustain? You work for who? Okay.
So they're fine.
They're fine? How about the other person back there? Is your restaurant doing great? Okay, so we're trying to sustain. Is it time to divest? Maybe it's time for us to get out of whatever it is we're doing, a strategic direction. And of course, maybe it's a time to invest. In a small company, maybe this isn't too big a deal to figure out. But imagine a big company with multiple strategic business units, and each strategic business unit has multiple brands, and each brand has multiple items. How are you planning for that? Fortunately, there's a way to do that. Often referred to at the strategic level as product portfolio analysis. The most well-known product portfolio approach is something by the Boston Consulting Group, or BCG, called the BCG model. And the notion is that we're going to base our analysis of our brands, of our products, of our SBUs on two important factors, which research has shown to be important. It's hard saying words. So on the left-hand side, the question is, looking out at the market itself, how fast is it growing? Okay? And here you can see that their dividing point is, if you're growing year over year at greater than 10%, it's considered high growth rate. Less than 10% down to pretty static, it's a low growth rate. Important to know for your strategic business unit, for your businesses, for your brands. And down here, how dominant are you? How big are you in this market? On the left-hand side, you're 10 times bigger than the next biggest competitor. Do you think you might have some advantages in a market where you're 10 times bigger than the competition? I would hope so. Are you a tenth of the size of the next bigger competitor? You're a teeny little bitty player. Your options are limited. So you can see that we have a 2x2 quadrant, four elements. When market growth rate is high and you're dominant, you have a brand, a product, a SBU called a star. When you're high in terms of your dominance of the market, but the growth rate is low, you have what's called a cash cow. When you are in a market that's growing rapidly and you are small, you have what's called a problem child or a question mark. And when you're a teeny in a market that isn't doing anything, you got a dog. All right? This has implications for what you should do. Let's look a little more at these. All right, so a cash cow. You are dominant in a low growth market. What does this mean? Well, by definition, there's low growth in sales. It's not going gangbusters. So things are growing slowly, they're chunking along, they're not declining, but it's slow growth. Because you're such a big player, you should have some pretty good profits rolling in off of this strong growth, not low growth, but strong position in a low growth market. So you're going to generate a lot of cash with your cash cow. So what does this mean in terms of management? You shouldn't take a lot of attention, shouldn't take a lot of resources to stay where you are. Obviously, it's something to stay powerful, it's to stay dominant. But you're really big compared to the competition. Fine. So what do you do with all that money? Well, among other things, you go over to the other quadrant where the problem children are, and select the ones that you want to invest in. We'll see what that means in a second. All right, invest in the problem children. The problem children are in a market where there's high growth in sales. In general, when a market has high growth in sales, do you know the expression, a raising tide raises all ships? Is that a familiar phrase? So whether you're a strong player or a weak player, there's a lot of growth going on. You're probably doing okay. But if you're a small player, you don't have very strong profits. It's costing you a lot of money to stay going. So what you have to decide is, in those problem children, in those question marks, which ones can you invest in to do what? Make them dominant. And which one should you just stop investing in and let them drift down to be dogs? So that's your strategic thinking. If you are dominant in a high growth market, you have high growth in sales. It's profitable because you're really big and the market is growing, but it does require attention. Competition would like to move in to your territory in this high growth area. So it does require cash and resources to stay dominant. What's going to happen over time to any market that's growing really rapidly, what's going to happen eventually? It's going to slow down. It's going to go under 10% at some point in time. And isn't going to be sweet when you have the dominant brand, the dominant product, the dominant strategic business unit in that area that now has slow growth. You're the boss. There's not a huge amount of growth. Cash is rolling in. Cash cow. And then those poor dogs. You have a product, a brand, a strategic business unit with low growth in sales. Things aren't happening. So your profits are pretty weak because you're not a big player. It's expensive to be there. They aren't going to generate much cash flow. So the future is pretty weak. This is not a place where most folks would feel you should be reinvesting money. Maybe you should divest. Maybe you should get out. Sell off. It's not for you. Or kill it. Nobody wants it. So, again, this is a simplistic view, which, of course, is much more complicated at the underlying level, but you can sort of picture how someone might go into their thousands of brands, hundreds of product lines, dozens of SBUs, and figure out strategically what's going on, where they stand, and what they need to do. So let's think about Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola Classic is still a big player, but it's not in a fast growth market, right? So growth in cola sales, Coca-Cola sales, general cola sales is not huge. But they're still a dominant player. That's their cash cow. For them, when I put this together, I haven't bothered checking recently, Minute Maid orange juice. There was a lot of orange juice being sold. They're not a big player. They have to decide what they're going to do with that over time. When I put this together, what am I drinking today? I'm drinking an off-brand of water today. Dasani was a star. High growth market. And they were pretty dominant there. And then for them, a couple of dogs. Coca-Cola Life, they rolled it out. Wasn't going anywhere. Nobody wanted it. They weren't big. And Coca-Cola Black, which again, I'll talk about it way in the future. Anybody know Coca-Cola Black from something? I'll talk about it much later. So those are dogs. They got rid of them. Although sometimes they roll them back to be fun. Let's look at the same idea with Dell Computers, or the Dell Company. Right now, monitors are a pretty high growth area, especially with people being at home and having to ramp up stuff and see things on monitors, and they're a pretty big player. Computers, obviously Dell is a big player in computers, but PC computers are just not a high growth market. So they got a cash cow. For them, the Dell Cloud, okay, the cloud is growing, Google Cloud, OneDrive, etc. But they're not a big player. They have to head scratch on that one. And anybody have a Dell smartphone? I think not. That one didn't quite play out for them against the competition. So this is the idea of using the Boston Consulting Group model to think about your strategic planning. There's more than one way of doing this. This is another one created by GE, General Electric, back a while ago, called the Directional Policy Matrix. You can see it's not too far afield. In terms of its concept, on the left-hand side is the question of how attractive is this market to you? Okay? Low, attractive, medium attractive, or high attractive. And what's your competitive position? Are you strong, medium, or weak? And again, although there's nine boxes, you can get the sense here. If you are in a highly attractive market and you have a strong position, it probably doesn't require a PhD to figure out you ought to maintain your leadership. And if you're weak, in a low attractive market, you had to divest. Get rid of it. It's not working. Procter & Gamble is pretty strong and very attractive markets of cleaning products, razors, baby diapers. They're going to try to maintain their leadership. On the other hand, a while ago, they bought Duracell batteries. Are Duracell batteries a bad battery? Is something wrong with them? Would you buy a Duracell battery? You'd consider it. But it was not something that was really in their wheelhouse. They got it as part of an acquisition. And so they harvested that off. They sold it off, saying it's not fitting well with what we do. Not much attractiveness to us, and we aren't really a big player in it. Yeah? So again, you could vision how this might work, right? So we're thinking about what we're going to do to grow our brand because of the area we're in. And one thing we might be able to do is to sell more of our products to our current customers, right? Not the silliest idea I ever heard of. This is called a growth strategy of market penetration. We're going to sell more products to current customers. Maybe that involves some special promotions. Maybe there's a price, maybe there's a sale, maybe there's a two-for-one deal. Maybe you explain better to your current customers how they'll be happier if they use more of your product, yeah? Or, alternatively, maybe what we want to do is sell a new product to customers that we know well, to our current customers. This is product development. So we're going to sell new products, things we haven't sold before, to customers that we know very well, through channels of distribution we probably know very well, because they're our current customers. So let's come up with a beer that's zero carb. Maybe we'll pick up a few other beer, you know, potential beer drinkers, but I assume a lot of our current beer drinkers are into that low-carb idea. We're going to sell this new product to our existing consumers. Yeah. What about selling our current products out to a new set of customers? Maybe run a new set of ads. Maybe we find a new benefit. Maybe we find a new channel of distribution. Maybe we roll out to a foreign country, global marketing, where they don't have our product now, so we're selling our existing product to new customers. Growth, 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 as long as you can do it right and successful. Or we might take the final approach, which is we might grow by selling new products to us to a new customer base we don't know about. You can see that that could be a little tricky. It's called diversification. We don't know the customer base and we don't know the product very well. That requires a little management talent. That requires a little skill. That requires a lot of research and a little luck to make that work. So based on our analysis, we can begin to think about if we're going to grow, how are we going to grow? Yeah? We good? So of all companies, we know Sony, right? How many people know Sony as a brand, right? We know Sony. Do you think of Sony? And naturally what comes to mind is electric vehicles. What? What? Sony is setting up a new electrical vehicle unit as it considers entering into the EV car market. That's going to be interesting. It's a product we don't know anything about, to a customer base we don't know anything about. The whole market is new. We'll have to see what happens, right? So that's sort of interesting. So we're out there, we have our mission, objectives, strategies, we know if we're growing or divesting. How are we doing? How are we doing? Well, one way we know what we're doing is through what are called marketing dashboards. Marketing dashboards are visual displays on a single computer screen of the essential information related to achieving a marketing objective. We had something in mind for growth. How are we doing? We have something in mind for certain profit. How are we doing? We had something in mind for certain market share or a certain sale of units. How are we doing? How are we doing by area? How are we doing by store? How are we doing by brand? Might be nice to know if we're going to manage what we're doing.
First of all, the internet has made a huge, huge increase in the amount of information that comes available. First of all, as the general manager of the store, it almost has made it to where we get too much information. We get too many items available to view. If I sat there and looked at dashboards all day long, which are available, I would be there all day just looking at the internet and numbers, that type of thing. But I have the ability of information systems that we use at the dealership that actually can tell me where sales processes are or where sales are in all departments at any given time. I can look at it 24/7. I have the ability to look at it when I'm not at work. But dashboards play an integral part. I can see how many customers have walked into the store, how many of those customers have taken it through that step-by-step process, where they are in that process, to where we've actually sold them, and where then are they have gone into finance yet, that type of thing. Where is the deal after it's left finance? Have we been paid from the bank? I can follow a deal anywhere from the beginning to end. And the same thing with my service department. I have the ability to look from the moment a customer walks into the door and we write a repair order on it to the point to where we get paid at the very end, whether it be from the bank or from Toyota themselves. But dashboards have created it so much, it's so much easier to look and get information at a glance at any point in time. You can see where you're at in a business standpoint of view. So yes, I use them every day.
So we set this up. We know that we want our ads to be driving a certain number of customers into the store. Is that happening or not? We know that we want a certain number of people come in the store to buy a car. Is that happening or not? If it's not happening, so you guys are doing a great job at sales. You guys don't seem to be doing what they're doing, or you don't seem to be matching our standards. First of all, I got to evaluate it, and as a manager, I got to figure out what the problem is. Maybe I have to send you guys off to do some additional sales training. You guys, I have to compliment because you're doing well. On the other hand, some of you people are sending customers over to our credit department. Great, but they're not getting paid. I have to retrain on that because I want my money to come in. So I'm using dashboards to compare how I'm doing against my goals and to evaluate them and then decide managerially what am I doing next to fix any problems. Dashboards help us to evaluate how we're doing and fix problems. Lots of examples out there. This is a company called iDashboards, driving business decisions. So it's a commercial product that is B2B. They're selling products to folks that want to get involved in dashboards. Here's a retail sales tracker dashboard. In this sales tracker dashboard example, we're tracking key performance indicators, KPIs, if you don't know that term, you should, that are crucial to the retail industry. While with sales tracking dashboard like this, retail organization can keep track of sales and inventory from multiple locations using data from multiple sources. Each location can be seen on a map, etc., etc. So here we can see in this real-time map how things are happening. What's our total sales per labor hour? What's our total sales per unit? What's our total sales for all? How are things going in uptown? How are things going in downtown? How are things going in midtown? What's selling? What isn't selling? What's going on by hour? What's going on by sales category? Accessories, trousers, t-shirts, jackets. Would this give you a fine-grained analysis of how your marketing efforts, your marketing mix, your sales strategy is playing out? You bet it does. So where are my ITIS people? We had hardly any last time. That's what I need you doing behind the scenes to take the stuff from all my salespeople, get it in the system so I can see in almost real time what's going on. So that's the back office stuff that helps us to manage our products and brands better. So he goes on now to talk about using dashboards in another area, media effectiveness.
The biggest thing is I notice is I use it to measure the type of media that I might be using. If I have a newspaper ad that has a date on it, that the sale goes from this day to this day, might be a 3-day period, I'll look and compare on that dashboard to see, did I get an increase in traffic flow at that point in time? And it can tell me right now, right away, what they did. Even in that dashboard, it can tell me, where we have it defined down from the salesperson, the information they entered in, what source of media did they actually use to come into the store. And, you know, we'll be able to track it and see, did that piece work for us? You know, we talk about dashboards and that type of thing. I mean, reports are just unbelievable, but we actually put a different phone number on types of media. So I can track it to see if that actually made an increase in customer awareness or the ability to come into our store. So yes.
So you run an ad in the Hudson Hub, you run an ad in the Stowe Center, you had an ad in the Record Courier. Hi, how you doing today? Are you interested in buying a car? You are. Well, how'd you hear about us? Or at the front desk, they're phoning in, you can see the phone number. And you're beginning to see in virtual real time, how are your ads doing? Do you need more in the Record Courier? Do you need less in the Hudson Hub? How is it playing out for you to help you move along with your marketing mix, with your marketing strategy, right? So we are using data to, as I've already talked about, take effective actions to make sure that we're moving on towards our goals, our objectives, and our strategic plan. At a high level, and it's on our chart that we'll move back to again, as we think about making these strategic decisions, we engage in what's called SWOT analysis. Again, we've heard of this before. SWOT? Have? Anybody not? Just curious if it's not a term we know. All right. So SWOT analysis is a way of helping us to think about the situation we find ourselves in and what we should be doing. Stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Just like I said, you have to understand your competencies, where you stand right now, what are your strengths, and then the flip side is internally, what are your weaknesses? And then outside the organization, what are your opportunities and what are your threats? So internal factors are strengths and weaknesses. My example was my salespeople over here are pretty strong. My salespeople over here have some weaknesses. We're having problems on the finance side. That might be a weakness. My service side is going strong. So in an auto dealership, I have a variety of, if you will, product lines to think about. So where am I weak? What are my external opportunities and what's threatening me? So I'm going to use that analysis. So here we are back in our framework. We're thinking about setting our company mission and objectives. We're doing this assessment. There's SWOT over there on the left-hand side, helping us to assess our market opportunities. Where are we strong? Where are we weak? Where do you have opportunities? Where do you have threats? What should we do next? So this is Fred Hunt over at Sherwin-Williams. He's big into SWOT analysis. He says this is one of the most important things that we take out of the MBA program and apply in the real world. Although when you get down to the front line, you use other techniques. SWOT is high-level stuff. Here we go.
There are a few techniques from the MBA experience that gets used any more than the SWOT analysis. You know, as it may not be formally said, but in almost not every meeting, but when we start talking about strategy, you almost always go back to that because it really helps to ground where you are. And ask the questions of yourself, the deep questions, not of yourself, but also those who work with you. Are we really there? Are we doing what we're supposed to do? And where do we see the strengths, the weaknesses, the opportunities, the threats? And from that comes, on each one of those points, potentially a much larger strategy, but you at least need to be honest with yourselves and start at that point. There are other techniques that we use as we move down the and try to get down to a more refined strategy, but that really is a core for many discussions.
So it is real. It's used all the time in business. It's a way of thinking strategically about what we are. So what are actions are proposed from this analysis of strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats? Well, if you find a weakness, you sales guys aren't doing as well as these guys over here, what should you try to do? Well, find a way to convert that weakness into a strength. Either train them up better, get a good sales program going, or maybe let them go and hire in a better bunch of people. Sorry, guys. So you got to find ways to convert your weaknesses into strengths. You don't know anything about NFTs, but it's a growing part of the market, and the competition seems to be there. Maybe hire in some talent for NFTs. If you have a threat out there, the question is, what can you do about it? If there's nothing you can do about it, then find a way to avoid it, because it's going to be a fail. You can't do anything about it. Or find a way to convert that threat to an opportunity. People are changing their taste in beer and their diets, and they're interested in no carbs, and beer has carbs. Well, what are we going to do? Wait a minute. Let's come up with a no-carb beer for our consumers. It's an opportunity. It's an opportunity that we can work with, convert that threat into an opportunity if we can't. You know, if it's something we can do something about. And what happens when you get that sweet spot? There's an opportunity that matches your strength. Jump on that puppy because you ought to be able to do something with it. It matches your core competencies. It matches your talent. It matches your resources. It's a strength for you. Go after it. Make it happen. It's a stretch to think about Sony going to electronic vehicles, right? Electric vehicles. GM moving over to an all EV platform, seems like that ought to work. It's an opportunity where they have some strength. So from our first day, we had, his name escapes me, over at Prodigy. Prodigy is a research company. And he talks to us about doing SWOT analysis at Prodigy. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. I know you.
Prodigy, the flagship brand that we are founded under is Swagbucks. That is a member rewards platform. In addition to that, we also acquired three other similar rewards platforms that complement Swagbucks. We have 120 million members globally. Anything that you would do online, such as shopping, booking travel, watching videos, playing games, our members can come to our websites and earn points back, much like you would be used to by using your credit card. Back in 2009, our chief revenue officer, Mendy, he saw an opportunity for one of those avenues to earn points back being answering a poll. When they put that out to our ecosystem of members, he saw that there was a trend in people really being willing to share their opinions. And so that kind of started what became our market research side of the business. From 2009 to 2014, we were kind of behind the scenes. Really, not many people knew about us, and even in the industry. And that was because we were selling the wholesale relationship to some of the other big research firms. So we were powering their surveys in the background. After 2014, we saw an opportunity to move direct and have more relationships with, say, a Kent State or market research firms or agencies. And so now we work with a slew of clients, thousands of clients that are really in any industry that has like a marketing team or an insights team that would want to pick up on trends, whether it's for testing ad concepts, new products that they're coming up with, store displays, what have you.
So they grow through acquisition, they're mulling over what to do, they see this opportunity, give their existing consumer base rewards for answering polls as well as reward dollars for buying products, and bada bing, bada boom, they find themselves in a huge growth area. It matches their membership base as a strength and leads to marketing research as an entirely new and growing business for them, and it grows to support lots of businesses who need consumer research on a B2B side. So SWOT analysis worked out for them pretty nice. All right, so step two is the market, product, focus, and goal setting. The idea here is that not everybody wants the same thing from us. As we think about our strategic growth, not everybody wants the same thing from us. So we have to identify what different groups of people want from us. These groups are called market segments. So a market segment is a group of consumers who have common needs, wants and desires, and they will respond differently to a specialized marketing mix that we come up with. What if people don't perceive there to be any importance to or any difference to carb and low-carb beers? They're indifferent. They don't care. To them, it's the same thing. Would it make sense for us to develop a low-carb beer? No. Would we sell any more beer if we had a low-carb beer? No, because everybody's going to react the same thing, the same way to it, because to them it's the same thing. There's not really a segment out there. You've wasted your time and your energy and your money. You don't actually have a market segment. Might there be a group of consumers who indeed care about how much carb there is in their beer? Presumably they know what they're doing, so we'll say yes. And are you suddenly getting a whole bunch of other beer drinkers who don't care about carbs to buy that beer? Probably not. They're happy with the beer they got. But now you have a different segment over here. That segment has common needs, wants, and desires, and they'll respond differently to that marketing mix. Oh, zero carb. Get me some of that. As we divide up all those people out in the marketplace into different segments, groups of people with different needs, wants, and desires from other groups of people, again, we probably can't market to them all. So we select one or two or a few market segments to target. We call them target markets. So this is the idea of selecting one or more segments, developing a marketing plan to serve them. Large companies can have all kinds of market segments. Smaller companies can't. They've got to focus on one or two. They don't have the resources, the wherewithal. So I said we started at the 30,000-foot level. We're assessing the market opportunities that are out there, whether they're B2B or B2C, and thinking about how we're going to do that. That leads to evaluating those market segments, figuring out who they are, and then figuring out which ones we can serve, selecting particular target markets that we're then going to develop marketing plans to serve. Obviously, we have to know what our customer value proposition is, our unique selling proposition. What is it that you're going to promise the consumer to satisfy their needs, wants, and desires? Obviously, this thing has to be relevant. No one cares about low carb. You shouldn't have wasted your time making a low carb beer. Has to be clear so the consumer understands what it is you're talking about. And this value proposition has to state why your consumer should purchase from you and not the competition. This becomes your point of differentiation. And you should know what that is going to be as you develop the thing. You shouldn't have to, after the fact, say, well, gee, why should somebody buy this from us? Bad way to go. It's part of the planning process, okay? Relevant, clear, and should be your point of differentiation that gives the consumer their value proposition. So we're down towards marketing objectives and marketing strategy.
Jumbo shrimp marketing.
Yes, hold on a second. So this is a fun little piece that I bring in because it lets us think about growth, but not growth for growth's sake. So it talks about how to grow, but by thinking small. Jumbo shrimp, a different way of thinking about your marketing planning.
Jumbo shrimp marketing. Get bigger by acting smaller. When small businesses dream, they usually dream of becoming a bigger business. When you think about it, nearly every big business began as a small business. Nike's first sale came from the trunk of a car. Dell shipped its first custom-built computer from a college dorm room. And Starbucks, well, began its life as a mom-and-pop coffee shop. However, a bigger business doesn't always equate to being a better business. At some point, big becomes bad. Big becomes a matter of being convenient rather than being unique. Big becomes a game of market share, not customer care. Big becomes ubiquitous. Seems by the time a small business gets big, it's time for it to act small again. Paradoxical? You betcha.
So when you focus on growth for growth's sake, pretty soon you find yourself not really caring that much about the customer. You've shifted your focus to the wrong sort of thing. And their claim is, obviously McDonald's is successful, Walmart is successful. That's not going to work for every company. So I suggest you think about these ideas. First of all, focus on being the best, not focusing on being the biggest. If you're focusing on being the best for who? The best for your target market, the best for your consumer. If you're the best for your consumer, I bet it helps lead to growth. Love your business. Really care about what it is you're doing. Know that your passion attracts passion. Passionate employees, passionate customers. Treat employees like family. The employees are the thing that is going to help deliver your promise to your passionate consumers. Make sure that you're treating them right, that you're satisfying their needs, wants, and desires as employees. And redefine success. Rethink what it means to be successful. Maybe it's not 20% growth a year or 25% growth a year for the next 10 years. Maybe there are other ways to think about what it means to be successful. So anybody have a retailer, a company, a business they work with or work for that fits any of these definitions, where they love their business, where they're passionate about what they do? Maybe you're passionate about working with them. Anybody have any? Can you yell out what that is, sort of?
I worked at an ice cream shop for a few years in my hometown.
Terrific. She worked in an ice cream shop. They loved it. The consumers loved it. It was a small town. Their definition of growth wasn't to become a nationwide ice cream shop. They were satisfied with what they were doing, satisfying passionate consumers with passion locally. They had pretty good ice cream?
Yeah.
Okay. This is an example of a company that plays off on this idea of good service through being small.
Hey, if you want all the technology and products of a big bank, but with the personal attention of a true local bank, head to Farmers National Bank. Farmers, bigger small banking.
I don't know if they saw that material or not, but they have that basic idea. Bigger, small banking. You get the satisfactions you get at a bigger bank from us, a smaller bank. Step three, design the marketing program. What are the four P's of the marketing mix? Anybody name one of them for me? Yes? Price. Yo. Product. You, yes. Place. Promotion. And you can read it off the screen behind me or on your sheets. Product, price, place, promotion. I know it's there. So product, price, place, promotion. Designing the marketing program to satisfy the needs, wants, desires of that target market or those target markets to fulfill your objectives and strategy in a meaningful way. Product, price, promotion, and place or distribution is sort of that next step down. And again, we're showing it as a circle, meaning it's integrated with the consumer at the center. So here's where we are, working our way down from the 30,000-foot level to the 10,000-foot level-ish above what you do every day. Product, price, distribution, and promotion. So they all have to work together. This is a slide from the book indicating that. You have a marketing manager looking over the product with features, brand name, packaging, service, warranty, price, promotion, advertising, personal selling, public relations, sales promotion, direct marketing, the place. And they've all got to fit together to make it make sense to be successful. Then you've got to implement the plan, get those resources. If you're an entrepreneur, where's that money coming from? Friends, family, credit cards, small business loans? If you're a massive organization, how are you getting money out of the board or wherever your budget is coming from? Design the marketing organization that's going to fulfill this particular plan. Develop the various schedules for production, media, sales, etc., inventory, and execute the marketing
There's
program.
A tool we use.
So this is Muller over Timken thinking about these elements for us.
There's a tool we use, and I don't know whether it's used widely. It's called SharePoint, and I'm guessing it's probably a Microsoft tool. And we use it to create these communities of interest on key performance indicators. And besides having that information available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we also review those key performance indicators monthly in performance reviews where we compare our business plan against actual results and whether it's, you know, the financials, revenue, profitability, all the way down to warehouse error rates, customer service, number of calls, abandoned call rate, all the details of running a business. We review those key performance indicators every month. It's a pretty rigorous process. And there's no escaping it. Everyone goes through it every month, and it really has created a nice rigor in our business that everyone expects it. Everyone watches those, and I think, as a lot of people said, you know, what you measure, people will pay attention to, and their behavior will respond to what you measure. And so we try to make sure we measure the right things.
Okay. Does SharePoint sort of pop it up on your screen in an integrated fashion, so you see it minute by minute, day by day, or is it a once a month sort of thing you look at?
It's basically something that you have to go look at, but it does so in a way that in the morning when you log on and the very first screen you see is a list of all the SharePoints that you have determined as an individual are important to you.
Okay, so first of all, this is a form of a dashboard, right? Doing those key performance indicators like we were talking about over at Toyota. Second of all, as a basic management principle, people pay attention to what you measure. I was talking to a faculty member some years ago, and he was complaining that students weren't reading the book. I said, well, that's not very good. They're buying the book, and they aren't reading the book. Why do you think that might be? I said to him, what percentage of your tests cover the book? Do you know what it is in our class, roughly? What percent covers the book? 60% of the book, 40% of the lecture. But that's okay. But the point is, it's there. He said, no, I don't test on the book. What? So he wanted them out of, you know, their quest for knowledge to study the book. But he wasn't going to test on the book. Bad management principle. What's a basic principle of management? People pay attention to what you measure. If you've got a plan in place with marketing goals and objectives that you want people to reach, you got to measure it. It introduces rigor. And you then have to hold people to the standard. You guys still haven't come up on those car sales. We're going to have to talk at the end of this month. You have to hold people, know what the standards are, measure them against the objectives, and then do something about it. You're a manager. Yeah, expecting people to do stuff that you don't measure, don't pay attention to, don't evaluate, not smart. So we're down here at this level. We've come up with a marketing program. We're looking at the marketing response. The feedback in terms of sales or number of people coming to the store or the brand attitude, whatever it is you're looking for, is part of evaluation and control back into the whole process, right? So that's the circle we've come through in our little 2 weeks together. Just because this is where it is in the book, you're going to come up on Appendix A. Appendix A is not testable. Talk about measuring things that people are going to pay attention to. Not testable, but you might find it interesting. It describes how to build an effective marketing plan, and we are not going to mess about with that level of detail in this principles course. So if that's of interest to you, it's there. Don't worry about studying it for the upcoming test, though. So this brings us around to Chapter 3. If I have it right, Chapter 3 is Lecture Notes, page 49, Scanning the Marketing Environment. So in the context of what we've been talking about, we can certainly understand the importance of knowing what's going on outside our organization, because it's going to impact our consumers and impact us. Pandemic, anyone? So environmental scanning is the process of continually acquiring information on events occurring outside the organization to identify what those events are, to figure out what the trends might be, to interpret what they might mean for our consumers and for ourselves, to plan for it. It requires data collection and intelligent assessment and interpretation of the information. Marketing research types presumably are doing that sort of work. Strategic thinkers are doing that sort of work. So again, where are we? We're over here on the monitor and predict environmental factors side of our model. There's our CREST factors, what's going on with competition, regulation, economic, social, and technological changes, and how will it impact the consumer? Because it's going to impact us. So we've got to be thinking about that. So here it is surrounding our model. Elements of competition, regulation, legal, and political, economic, social change, and technology changes. Social changes, of course, are interesting in how they impact business. How many of you guys either have a tattoo or know someone who has a tattoo? Let me say, when I grew up, the only people with tattoos were convicts and sailors. It wasn't a thing. And there was no opportunity when I grew up for there to be three different tattoo parlors in downtown Kent, or whatever there is now. It wasn't a thing. What happens? Changing social norms are reflected by changing consumers' attitudes, values, and behaviors, which then reflect in different business opportunities for companies, for organizations. What's going on in the social milieu that your consumers might be affected by? NFTs are only made possible because of something called blockchain computer finance stuff. It's not possible without it, right? Those changing environments affect our consumers and affect our business. So let's take a look at one of these factors. Let's take a look at the social forces, which are factors in a society that bring about changes in consumers' attitudes, beliefs, norms, customs, lifestyles. Tattoos weren't a thing, they are a thing. Piercings weren't a thing, they are a thing. These affect how people live and what, where, and how they buy. Seems like it would be important to us to know about, to track on, to think about. Obviously, COVID-19 has affected our life in huge ways and affected how people live, yeah. What, where, and how they buy, yeah. It's had an amazing impact on our society. One social force are demographics. So we have to know what's going on in a population's characteristics such as their age. There's no reason you know this other than the general knowledge base. What generation of Americans was the biggest generation? Who was the biggest one? The baby boomers were the biggest one, and we used to talk about the influence of the baby boomers in society as like this big ball of thing the snake had eaten, and it's moving through the snake, but it has a massive influence on the snake. Is that still true today? The baby boomers still the biggest. They are not, okay? I think, what did we say, the Gen Z is, maybe? Anyhow, it's no longer them. What's going on, and how are those changes going to impact the marketplace? Gender, ethnicity, income, occupation, and all these are, of course, impacted by COVID as well. There's lots of data sources out there for this sort of stuff. These are just some fun sources for information on population. So here is the U.S. and the world population clock. So right now, the U.S. population, 3,332,461 people and 88. One birth every 9 seconds, one death every 11 seconds, one international migrant net every 130 seconds, a net gain of one person every 40 seconds. And we aren't going to get over to, yes, it's fine, thank you. And over here, we aren't going to get to the 7 billion people on the world, but the 10 most populous countries, China, India, United States, Indonesia, and Pakistan. So here's the various information that you might find of interest if you were involved in this sort of study. Here they are by age group, etc. So data is out there. It might be interesting. I forget if this one was also interesting. Coronavirus update. Births this year. Deaths this year. Government economics, spending. computers produced this year. So if you were involved in some field for which these were relevant, this sort of general data might be interesting, and of course there's more specific information as well. Moving on to this idea of generational cohorts, okay? Which is what we're just alluding to. We're going to start with a list from the textbook and then drift a little bit into my version of it, and we'll run out of time there shortly thereafter. So the baby boomers, born 46 to 64, a huge factor on society for a long number of years, but declining. The old farts are dying off. Generation X, born 65 to 76. Generation Y, 77 to 94. And generation millennials, the younger Gen Ys, the researchers can't always agree on the dates, so I have a question mark, 81 to 94. And Gen Z, probably isn't the biggest one now, Gen Z is 95 to 2010. And we'll talk about in my section, those born after that time period. So the resident population of the United States in 2020 by generation in millions, here we go. It's the millennials that are now the largest. Baby boomers are still out there. They were really big, but they're dropping down in terms of them being around. And there's still a couple of the really, really old folks out there that we're going to talk about in a little bit and their impact on us as well. So, so in 2020, the millennial generation became the largest. So a bit more broadly than the textbook goes into, we're going to start thinking a little bit about those that are really old. The greatest generation, born 1901 to 1945, with a subset of the Depression cohort era, 1912 to 21, World War II cohort, 22 to 27, post-war cohort, 28 to 45. Baby boomers come in two flavors, at leading edge, 46 to 55, and the trailing edge, 56 to 64. Gen X, 65 to 80. Millennials, 81 to 95. Gen Z, 96 to 2010. I assume that's most of you. Also known as iGen, Gen Tech, Digital Natives, and NetGen. And Generation Alpha. Generation Alpha, they ran through the alphabet. X, Y, Z, oops. They come around to Alpha now. So Generation Alpha is 2010 to this moment in time. So these cohorts, the reason we think about them is they represent potential target markets. And you can imagine that the needs, wants, and desires of some old baby boomer are a lot different than the needs, wants, and desires of some young Gen Z or Alpha, obviously. So we need to know what these needs, wants, and desires are in these target markets. So let's back up in time a little bit and think about one of the oldest groups that stood around, the Depression cohort, or the GI generation, born 1912 to 1921. Anybody know any great-grandparents? Anybody still have anybody that's around more than 100? Oh, holy mackerel. More than 100. Wow. Okay, well, they're still there then, and they still have purchasing power. That's more than I thought, by the way. This group's coming-of-age experience consisted of the economic strife, elevated unemployment rates, and having to take menial jobs to survive. So for them, financial security was what they lacked when they came of age, as they were growing up. It rules their thinking. Having lived through the Depression, this cohort prefers to pay more for a smaller serving rather than throw something away. Have you ever had great-grandma yell at you for not eating your food or throwing away something that's good? No? Yeah? Maybe? They're not a key target audience now, but their values, the things that they value because of what they grew up with, still influenced marketing. For example, given their earlier preferences when they were younger and still spending more, single-serving products that they preferred, they'd rather pay more and for the individual serving, not throw it away, are now becoming popular. Maxwell House filter pack singles, Pillsbury single-serve cakes, Orville Redenbacher single-serve microwave popcorn are all examples that in part were driven by this cohorts group desire to not waste, for example, food. The silent generation, the World War II cohort, born 22 to 27, age 95 to 100 now, they sacrificed for the common good, an accepted way of living in this cohort, evidenced by women working in factories for the war effort, men going off to fight. Overall, this cohort was focused on defeating a common enemy, and their members are more team-oriented and patriotic than those of other generational cohorts, which means that has a theme that you might reach them with in your advertising. In terms of communication, because of their age, this cohort prefers print media for information. They read newspapers and magazines and ads more thoroughly than do other generations. It's what they grew up with. For the mature market in general, communicating often requires that you alter your message. You need larger type, clear, bright pictures, newspapers, AM radio, models they can relate to, and relatively simple language. They're getting up there in years. Post-war cohort, 1928 to 1945, 77 to 94 in 2022, they had a time of remarkable economic growth and social tranquility, a time of family togetherness, school dress codes, moving to the suburbs. There was some unrest in their upbringing, the Korean conflict and McCarthyism, but overall this was a pretty tranquil time, which is why it's such a long cohort in terms of number of years. Anybody know the Vermont Country Store? I'm not going to have time to show the piece on it, so I'll tell you what it is. And I actually have catalogs at home I meant to bring in because we get catalogs from the Vermont Country Store. A highly successful marketers of nostalgic products, difficult to find products, they use the cohort images and memories to target various market segments. To capture the attention of post-war cohort customers, it carries many oldest brands and even brings them back to life. An odd place to stop, but that's I'm about out of time. This will be the end of the material for this week, lectures 3 and 4. The end of material for mini-test 2 opens Friday, closes Tuesday. Mini-test 1 and mini-test 2 comprise your attendance in the course. Don't miss the exams, please. See you next time.